Hello, everyone, and welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Friday, February 26, 2021. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m., Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region, and each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. And now let's take a look at today's weather. Our weather calls for some patchy fog in central Iowa today, with the winds from the south-southeast at 3 miles per hour, a high today of 47, with a low of 24. On Saturday, we can expect some light rain with a high of 45 and a low of 27, and on Sunday, partly cloudy, with a high of 35 and a low of 25. Across the state, expect a high of about 44 degrees, sunshine and clouds mixed, with a slight chance of a rain shower, and our highs again near 44 degrees, with the winds from the south-southeast at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Our sunrise today was at 6:53 a.m. and will set at 6:01 p.m., our moonrise at 5:22 p.m., and the moonset will be at 6:55 a.m. And now let's take a look at our first story in today's electronic version of the Des Moines Register. Our first story is written by Ian Richardson and comes from the Iowa Capitol State House. Iowa Senator delays push for Medicaid work requirements. As the Biden administration begins to withdraw federal approval for Medicaid work requirements in several states, the Republican state senator who has previously introduced work requirement bills in Iowa says he doesn't plan to resume his push this year. Senator Jason Schultz, Republican from Schleswig, said he is putting his effort on hold because he has other responsibilities as the new chairperson of the Senate Commerce Committee. However, he said he hopes to bring his bill back in the future. "You can expect to see it next year," he told the Des Moines Register. The effort would face an uphill battle if it resumes. The Biden administration has informed previously approved states that it will rescind federal approvals for Medicaid work requirements, and the administration has also indicated it's unlikely to approve future waivers. Schultz acknowledged that Iowa is unlikely to receive federal approval for work requirements, which the Trump administration introduced in 2018. "The waiver is probably a pretty long shot under a Biden administration," Schultz said, "but I'd also be more interested in dealing with it next year." The Republican-controlled Senate, for 2 years in a row, has passed Schultz's proposal to require able-bodied Iowans covered by the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan to meet work, volunteer, and educational requirements. Schultz and other Senate Republicans have said the bill could boost Iowa's workforce. Democrats and many social services agencies have opposed the bill, saying they worry people who need benefits will lose them, and many on Medicaid who are able to work already do. On Tuesday, the Senate, on a party-line vote, passed Senate File 359, a bill that would add verification steps, including a check of household assets, for food stamp applicants. The bill would also require an upgraded digital verification process for Iowans on public assistance programs, including food stamps and Medicaid. In late January, the Labor and Business Relations Committee held a subcommittee meeting on Senate Study Bill 1061, a bill that would classify someone guilty of fraudulent practice if they possess three or more electronic benefits transfer cards for food assistance that they aren't authorized to have. Senator Zach Whiting, Republican from Spirit Lake, who chairs the committee, told the Register on Thursday that the committee isn't planning to advance it this year. Both bills, like the work requirements, have failed to advance through the House in the past. But Schultz said he believes the idea of computerized verification has become more normalized each year, and he's optimistic it can pass this year. As of Thursday morning, House leadership has not assigned the bill to a committee. Also from the State House, Iowa expects to start COVID-19 vaccinations for some essential workers, people with disabilities, in early March. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Thursday that workers in industries where they can't socially distance and some individuals with disabilities likely will become eligible to receive COVID-19 vaccinations in early March. 70% of people within those populations are expected to receive at least one dose of the vaccine by the start of April, according to projections she shared at a news conference. That 70% milestone is among the factors the state is using to decide when it can begin vaccinating the next group of Iowans, Reynolds said. Now that vaccine supply is increasing, our administration rates are steady and allocations are provided weeks in advance. We're finally able to generally answer the questions that so many Iowans are asking, and that's, when is it my turn? Reynolds said, we can now project when eligible populations could reach critical vaccination milestones. Right now, Iowans 65 years and older, teachers, child care workers, and emergency responders are eligible to get the coveted COVID-19 vaccine. People who live and work in nursing homes and other health care workers were first to receive the shots. Reynolds said that by next week, the state is projecting 70% of the Tier 1 populations will have received at least one dose of the vaccine. She said 70% of Iowans 65 and older are expected to receive the first dose of the vaccine by mid-March. The progress with these groups allows the state to begin opening up vaccinations to other populations, including workers in food processing, agricultural production, distribution, and manufacturing, whose living or work conditions prevent them from social distancing. Individuals with disabilities living in home settings who require care staff will also become eligible, along with their care staff. In total, these tiers account for about 600,000 people, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health data. Vaccinations will open up to remaining priority groups and Iowans 16 years and older as supply increases, possibly beginning in April. Iowa Department of Public Health guidance names residents and staff at congregate settings, such as sober living homes, but excluding college dormitories, and government officials and staff working at the Iowa Capitol, as the next priority group. It totals about 13,000 Iowans. Reynolds emphasized that the projections could change as circumstances fluctuate. She noted that recent severe weather across the country disrupted the delivery of millions of vaccine doses. They're not hard dates, and some of the areas the state will be able to transition to their next eligible population more quickly than others, she said. So, of course, timelines will vary county by county. Some will need additional time based on the size of their populations, and estimates could change for a variety of other reasons. Jane Hudson, Executive Director of Disability Rights Iowa, said that although the state's projected timelines sound great, she remains skeptical that the Iowans who qualify will actually be able to access the vaccine. Everything has been so chaotic and poorly run and not centralized, she said, and people are falling through the cracks, especially people with disabilities. She said she is unsure which Iowans with disabilities will qualify under the state's current language. It could range from someone who has a professional provider coming in to care for them 24 hours a day in their home to someone who has a disability, who is living at home and gets help from family members once a week to clean up the house, she said. There needs to be clarity. Once people know whether they qualify, Hudson said, they will likely face other barriers. Many people with disabilities do not have access to the necessary technology to search out vaccine appointments. Some do not have the cognitive skills or the social support to do so, and many more cannot or should not drive to pharmacies administering the vaccine, she said. I think the state and the provider should be going to where the people are, just like they did with the nursing facilities, Hudson said. Walgreens and CVS went to where the people were, and they should be going to the home settings, and the group homes, and the home and community-based service places to deliver the vaccines. As more vaccine becomes available, Reynolds said Iowans should have an easier time making vaccination appointments. Demand for the vaccine continues to outstrip supply, and the current patchwork system of obtaining vaccine doses has left many Iowans confused or frustrated. A new website, www.vaccinate.iowa, will be available Friday to help streamline the process, Reynolds said. It will include a vaccine locator and answers to frequently asked questions. It won't allow Iowans to schedule vaccines directly, but it will connect them to provider systems where they can schedule those appointments. Reynolds said last week her office canceled a contract for vaccine scheduling to avoid further disruption to the state's systems. The state also hired vaccine navigators to reach out directly to seniors identified by area agencies on aging as having difficulty scheduling vaccines and helping them through it. Starting March 8th, those navigators will be available to seniors through the state's 211 hotline to help schedule appointments. Last week, the AARP sent Reynolds a letter criticizing the fragmented rollout as confusing and concerning for seniors trying to be vaccinated. In a statement Thursday, AARP Iowa State Director Brad Anderson said the governor using 211 and area agencies on aging was an excellent place to start this effort. The announcement that the state is taking steps to simplify and centralize the vaccination process is a terrific step forward, Anderson said in a statement. While there will be challenges ahead, the decrease in outbreaks in Iowa nursing homes shows what can happen when we prioritize vulnerable populations and quickly get shots in arms. So far, roughly 450,000 Iowans have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The vaccines available in Iowa each require two doses, taken weeks apart, to reach full efficacy. Up to 660,000 Iowans are eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine under Reynolds' current eligibility criteria, but those numbers will expand soon if the projections remain correct. Reynolds said there are several reasons to be optimistic about the state's vaccine distribution trajectory. She said the White House told governors during a weekly coronavirus briefing that the federal vaccine allocation to states will increase by another 1 million doses. And beginning next week, the White House will be able to forecast state allocation several months in advance, which will help with state-level planning. The FDA is also expected to approve a third vaccine from Johnson & Johnson, requiring only one dose, boosting vaccine supply across the country. I'm cautiously optimistic that the progress we're seeing now will only continue, Reynolds said. And I do appreciate the partnership of the federal government in helping make this possible. The progress we've made over the last several weeks is pushing us toward a turning point in our COVID-19 recovery, and I'm committed to continuing this forward momentum in Iowa. Iowa Public Health Association Executive Director Lena Tucker Reindeer said the increased vaccine supply will be key. The infrastructure is in place for administering the shots, and she estimated local health departments could handle at least double their current capacities, assuming the federal government can supply sufficient doses. It's not a question of can we manage the vaccine, it's can we get the vaccine, Tucker Reindeer said in an interview. An article now here from the Iowa Press Citizen. Ready for a change of pace amid controversies, University of Iowa's College of Dentistry dean announces plans to step down. This announcement comes after the college faced protests and accusations in January that it's home to a long-standing tradition of discrimination and bias, criticisms of a Trump administration executive order, and subsequent hearings with an apology to lawmakers in Des Moines. Amid controversies this school year, David Johnson, the dean of the University of Iowa's College of Dentistry, announced plans Thursday to step down. Earlier this fall, the college summoned one of its students to a disciplinary hearing for unprofessional behavior after he showed public support for a Trump executive order that had banned some diversity trainings by government agencies and contractors that received federal funding. Johnson, who has been with the university for more than 25 years, was called to testify about the incident before the Iowa House of Representatives Government Oversight Committee earlier this month. He apologized at the hearing for the college's decision to summon the student to a disciplinary hearing, as well as his decision as dean to publicly condemn the Trump executive order. We do not want any of our students to have an experience that leaves them feeling unsupported or fearful, he told the committee members, and we failed in that regard. Johnson said Thursday he plans to leave his post in June, a year earlier than expected. The university is expected to name an interim dean of the dental school this spring, while also in the midst of searching for a new university president to replace Bruce Harreld. Upon further reflection, I came to realize that the pieces are in place for me to step away at a year earlier than that, after more than 25 years. I am ready for a change of pace, Johnson said in a statement Thursday morning. I look forward to seeing the college continue our service to this state that I am proud to call home. 29 members of the college's staff, including Johnson, co-signed an email to the rest of the college's students, faculty, and staff, condemning Trump's October executive order. The email set off a string of replies, which included comments from one student, Michael Braze, who argued the college should follow the order. Testifying to legislators earlier this month, Johnson said Bray was summoned to the hearing because he used a public platform, replying to everyone on a college-wide email to share his views. The legislators were quick to point out that Johnson started the email chain in condemning the president's executive order, and Johnson agreed telling lawmakers his initial email should not have happened. Moving forward, I will not use my voice in an official capacity to comment about current political topics, Johnson told the committee. I have come to realize that by exposing an opinion, a dean on a political topic can chill speech rather than foster free speech. In response to the hearing, Iowa's Board of Regents approved policies Wednesday that would prohibit university presidents, vice presidents, deans, and department directors from taking positions on policies on behalf of the institutions they serve, unless they are made in conjunction with the regents. The move was one of 10 recommendations approved by the regents aimed at protecting free speech following incidents at all three of Iowa's public universities this school year. The College of Dentistry has also garnered attention this year after dozens of its students protested outside the college to call on administrators to take more action on his pledges around diversity and inclusion, saying student and faculty feel discriminated against within the college. The current atmosphere at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry has included a long-standing tradition of discrimination and bias, the protesters' organizers wrote on their website. Organizers also outlined their concerns in a petition, which has drawn about 1,600 signatures. The rigorous curriculum of the program should be what makes dental schools hard. Instead, a disruptive learning environment exists, one in which students question if their faculty or classmates will treat them differently based on the color of their skin, sexual orientation, mental or physical abilities, learning styles, gender, and more, the petition reads. Johnson said Thursday he plans to remain at the college as a professor of pediatric dentistry. He had previously announced his intention to resign as dean in the summer of 2022. David has served the college and the university with distinction over more than 2.5 decades. A statement from the executive vice president and provost, Kevin Craigle, Thursday read, "Under his leadership, the college has continually advanced its reputation as a premier dental school, a leader in interdisciplinary research, and a vital resource to the state of Iowa. He is a passionate champion of the college and ambassador for the university, and I have no doubts that will continue." From Ames, Iowa, Isabella Rosario writes an article, "An Absolute Sweetheart. Friends remember Ames woman allegedly killed by boyfriend." Renia Bell was the type to get reluctant people on the dance floor. "At an Ames high school prom, a lot of us didn't do the whole dancing thing," Eric Range recalled. "But she found a way to get the ones that didn't want to dance to get up and actually dance and have some fun." Long after graduation, Bell was still definitely the life of the party and enjoyed making spontaneous plans to go out to downtown bars. Her friend, Jamie Peters, said, "Niecy Deal introduced Bell and Peters when the three were in seventh grade. They all grew apart as life happened, but still kept in touch occasionally. Any time that I was with her, it was like no time had passed," Deal said. Police found Bell, age 37, dead in her Ames apartment Saturday night while performing a welfare check. Bell's boyfriend, Richard Fleck, 33, has been charged with first-degree murder. Police have said the death was caused by blunt force trauma. Fleck had been staying with Bell for about a month and is now believed to be in Kansas City, Missouri, but also has ties to communities in Texas and Mississippi, according to the police. Bell was an optician at Wiley Eye Care Center. She attended Ames High School and Des Moines Area Community College, where she studied to become a certified nursing assistant, according to her Facebook page. Range said Bell was an absolute sweetheart. When things were going bad for people, she was there to talk to them, Range said. No matter what the situation was, she wanted to be there to help you through whatever issues you were going through at the time. Peters echoed that sentiment, saying Bell was the kind of person who would literally just drop everything for a person in need. Bell was just as fun-loving as she was loyal, her friend said. Deal fondly remembers her high school friend group clowning around in class, supposed to be learning but not really paying attention. She had one of those laughs that was just absolutely infectious, Deal said. All living a couple of blocks from each other as kids, Peters and Deal said it was hard to pinpoint specific memories of their friends with whom they spent so much time. They spent summer swimming at the city pool, having sleepovers, going to movies, and walking around their neighborhood. As teenagers, they drove around and blasted Britney Spears music through the speakers. Any time I hung out with her was a really good memory, Deal said. Peter said Bell's death comes as even more of a shock because another woman in their close-knit high school friend group recently died of cancer. She was really close to Renia, so now I'm just sitting there thinking, well, now they're together, Peter said. It's just strange. Now Renia is gone, too. Back to our print edition of the Register today. The headline, $7.25 wage rarer, but owners wary of $15. Minimum wage hike hits snag in Senate. An increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour was struck late Thursday from a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package heading for a vote in Congress. The Senate parliamentarian ruled that the measure couldn't be part of the bill if the majority Democrats use a process called reconciliation to approve the bill with a simple majority vote. The fate of the drive for a higher wage now is uncertain, given it is unlikely to draw enough support from Republicans as a separate bill to overcome a filibuster. Des Moines Metro business owners like Christina Moffitt, who runs a boutique cupcake bakery just off the Des Moines Ingersoll Avenue corridor, has been watching the measure with mixed feelings. Moffitt said all of her employees at Cream Cupcake and Dessert already are paid above the federal and Iowa minimum hourly wage of $7.25. In fact, few businesses in the Des Moines Metro appear to be paying that little. I think it's too low, and honestly, your employees work hard, said Moffitt. The lowest rate Moffitt said she pays any of her current employees is $10. In addition, all workers share tips they make off catering projects and online orders, and take home any tips that they get while helping run the counter. The federal minimum wage has stayed stagnant since 2009, despite losing nearly 20% of its buying power to inflation since then, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Price Index Inflation Calculator. No state can set its wage lower than the federal one, though tipped employees in Iowa can get as little as $4.35, so long as their tips bring them to at least $7.25. The legislature in 2017 rolled back an effort by Polk County to raise its minimum to $8.75 an hour, as well as increases in some other Iowa counties. But BLS data shows that in the Des Moines Metro, more than 90% of workers in food and retail, including waitresses and cashiers, make wages above the $7.25 minimum. On a national level, 1.9% of all hourly paid workers earned wages at the federal minimum or below, according to BLS data from 2019. The Democrats in Washington had proposed to gradually raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. But several small business owners in Des Moines said that, like Moffitt, they're already paying at least $10. They include Chris Bordonero, the owner of Bordonero's Pizza, who said his starting wage for workers in training is to $10 to $11. Naughty Nail owner Becky Pospisil said the lowest hourly wage she pays anyone in her art studio in Valley Junction is $10. There also are some pockets of lower wages for non-tipped workers, though not $7.25. For instance, at Mayhem Comics and Games, which has locations in Ames and Des Moines, the lowest wage for part-time workers is $8.50, said James Gray, one of the owners. The fact that most starting wages in Iowa already are above the minimum wage, in and of itself, shows that the federal minimum must be adjusted, said David Swenson, an economics researcher at Iowa State University. Increasing the minimum wage has been the goal of a lengthy campaign fought by workers and labor interests who contend that keeping the current wage so low holds down pay even for workers who earn much more. Also, much data shows the current federal minimum wage is not sufficient to cover basic expenses, rent, food, transportation, and health care. According to MIT's Living Wage Calculator, the living wage for a single adult in Polk County is $14.24. For single adults with one child to support, it's $29.97. Across Iowa, the living wage for a single adult without children would equate to $13.87, according to MIT's calculation. Minimum wage employees in Iowa who work a standard 40-hour week cannot afford a one-bedroom home, according to a report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition from last year. In addition, Pew Research Center data shows the median wage for U.S. workers has remained stagnant for decades, even as overall wages have risen, which researchers say indicates that higher-wage workers are making disproportionate gains. For small business owners, support for the proposal to require $15 an hour in 5 years was less about whether the federal minimum wage should be increased and more about whether they can make that wage work financially for their companies. Gray, who runs his two collectible stores with staff who mostly work part-time, said he believes a $15 wage is possible and doable, but not an easy task. As a businessman, it definitely scares me, Gray said. An increased minimum wage would mean that there's a lot of money that needs to be found to make that so that it's fair for workers, and at the same time the store stays profitable, Gray said. But I also, as a person, believe that $15 an hour makes sense, he added. The wages people currently get don't seem to make sense with the inflation of a product, so it's definitely not an easy answer. Do I think my store can keep up with it? I don't know. Stephen James, owner of the Fat Tuesday Cajun restaurant in Des Moines, said that an increase of that size may be a burden for businesses and it might have to reevaluate menu prices where it will be enacted. You hope that customers understand that you do have to do what you do when you hike prices, and that's something you have to do to pay employees, James said. Others said that gradually phasing in the increase over 5 years would provide ample time to plan. Pizzle said 5 years would allow her to draw up a good blueprint for adapting her business to a higher wage. Do I think it will make some impact on some businesses? Yeah, but I would expect my employees making $15 an hour to step up their work level for me, she said. So for me, I'm able to plan ahead for that, and I'm certain that my business can't sustain that as minimum wage. Bordenaro said that a $15 is a big leap, but it might not be that way in 5 years. He added that although the potential having to reduce staff at his pizza place is something to be concerned about, the wage could be raised to $10 right now without a problem. Matt Johnson, manager of 515 Brewing Company in Clive, said he would favor an increase because of how it would support workers, although he recognized the objections that it could hurt businesses still suffering from the pandemic-related downturn. I can see where ownership would be like, oh my God, we're barely keeping the lights on the way it is. Now we need to give our employees more money. I can see the other side of the argument, Johnson said. I get it. I'm just very much in favor of making it better for people on the lower rung of the pay. Data indicates a higher minimum wage could work both in favor of workers and against them. According to a government report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the proposed increase in minimum wage to $15 by 2025 would have impacted 17 million workers who make below $15 an hour, and 10 million with wages a little above that. It said 900,000 people would have been lifted from poverty. However, the CBO's report also estimated that the $15 wage would have resulted in 1.4 million fewer jobs. As for the price of goods, the CBO's report said the largest increase to compensate for higher wages would have been at restaurants, which tend to rely on low-wage workers. On the other hand, a report by a group of researchers from the University of Washington, published in 2019, found no evidence of a change in food prices in the 2 years after Seattle voted to increase the minimum wage to $15 in phases. Speaking at a town hall in Milwaukee last week, President Joe Biden acknowledged the conflict that surrounded the wage hike proposal. "No one should work 40 hours a week and live in poverty," he said, "but it's totally legitimate for small business owners to be concerned about how that changes." Moffitt is among them. While she believes the current federal minimum is not enough, she worried about what raising the minimum to $15 would mean for her business. "I can't really say how I feel until it happens, because I really need to know if the consumers will support it," she said. "That's what I come back to." Moffitt wonders whether the consumer's threshold for the price of her treats would tolerate an increase to offset the higher wages, especially at a time when most food service businesses have seen a drop in business because of the pandemic. "So that's what concerns me, is that it's being implemented on businesses that are already stressed, and I don't know how much more they can handle," she said. "It's not that I don't like to think people should make a living wage, because I do, and I try to provide that for my employees. So it just concerns me. It comes back to what the consumers are really willing to pay for." And our last article on the front page, written by Stephen Gruber Miller, "Bill Shortening Early Voting Goes to Governor." Iowans would have less time to cast ballots either earlier or on Election Day under a bill headed to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk. After a five-hour debate, the Iowa House passed the bill on a party-line vote of 57-37 Wednesday night, with every Republican in support and every Democrat opposed. 6 representatives were absent. The House vote came a day after the Senate passed the measure, also on a party-line vote. Reynolds, a Republican, said Thursday that her team is reviewing the measure. Her spokesperson, Pat Garrett, said the governor does not plan to sign any bills this week. "I think we do it well in Iowa," Reynolds said of the state's elections. "I'm proud of our system. I think we're a role model for other states, but we should always be looking at ways that we can enhance and improve. The fact of the matter is, there are Americans across the state that have some concerns about what happened in this last election," Reynolds added. "And again, I think it's imperative, and it's not just understood, but they feel that there is integrity in the election process, and they feel that it's fair, and it's done in an equitable manner. If the legislation, Senate File 413, is signed into law, Iowans would have 20 days of early voting, down from 29 under current law. Polls would close at 8 p.m. for elections, instead of the current 9 p.m. cutoff for primary and general elections. Absentee ballots would have to arrive by poll close in order to be counted, rather than counting as long as they were placed in the mail the day before Election Day. And county auditors could face criminal charges for disobeying state law or failing to follow state guidance. Republicans say the bill would ensure election integrity and create uniform election practices across the state. Democrats, who are in the minority, describe the bill as a voter suppression and accuse Republicans of acting based on false claims of voter fraud. For 5 hours, they pleaded with Republicans to vote the bill down. "Why are we doing this in Iowa?" said Representative Sharon Steckman, Democrat from Mason City. "We had no fraud. We had a record turnout. People were happy with the way they got to vote absentee. 1 million people. And you better believe some of those people were Republicans, because you won. There is no evidence of widespread fraud in the 2020 election, despite claims to the contrary from many prominent Republicans, including former President Donald Trump." Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton, the House floor manager for the bill, said he believes Iowa's 2020 election was successful and it wasn't rife with fraud. Rather, he said, the bill is about looking at what did and didn't work and improving. "I heard time and time again in dozens of prepared remarks that this bill was derived from fraud," he said in his closing comments. "Fraud, fraud, fraud. So I apologize for ruining your prepared remarks by emphatically stating in the beginning of this debate, in the first sentence that came out of my mouth, that this bill has nothing to do with fraud." More than 1.7 million Iowans cast ballots in last year's election, nearly 76% of registered voters. That included more than 1 million people who voted early, either by mail or in person. Both those figures broke state records. According to data from the Iowa Secretary of State, 76% of Democrats and 52% of Republicans voted early in the 2020 election, either by mail or in person. Republicans, who maintain full control of Iowa's state government, have pointed to the record turnout to say that their previous changes to election law didn't suppress votes, and that this bill wouldn't either. But Democrats argue that the new legislation would restrict many of the practices that made the 2020 election so successful. I've got news for you. There were record votes in 2020 in spite of what Republicans did, not because of what the Republicans did, said Bruce Hunter, Democrat from Des Moines. Democrats criticized Republicans repeatedly during Wednesday's debate for reducing the time to vote early and on Election Day. Are voters asking for one less hour to vote? Said Representative Jennifer Confress, Democrat from Windsor Heights. I haven't heard a good reason that errs on the side of voting freedoms that would indicate any need to shorten the voting period by an hour. Kaufman said county auditors have asked for the earlier poll close time and said it brings Iowa's general elections in line with city and school elections when polls close at 8 p.m. He also said Iowans will still have plenty of time to vote early. It is really easy to vote absentee and early before this legislation, he said. It's going to remain really easy to vote after this legislation is signed into law. This bill protects Iowans' right to vote, and it adds certainty and security to it. This bill does not suppress one single vote. Democrats said if absentee ballots had been required to be returned by the close of polls in 2020, about 6,500 Iowans' ballots would have been counted. Confress said punishing voters because mail did not arrive on time doesn't pass the common sense test. The voter voted before Election Day, Confress said. Iowans' freedom to vote shouldn't be dependent on whether or not a ballot cast on Monday arrives at the auditor's office on Tuesday. Kaufman said he trusts Iowans to make voting plans that ensure their ballots are counted. You can't show up at the polls 10 minutes after they close and demand to vote, so your absentee vote should also be in when the polls close, he said. It wasn't until after House lawmakers had held a public hearing on the legislation and the bill had gone through the committee process that Republicans amended the bill to close polls an hour earlier on Election Day and to institute the hard deadline for auditors to receive absentee ballots by the time the polls close. Democrats were surprised by the additional restrictions because Republican legislators had said their amendment would focus on concerns raised about making sure overseas and military voters, survivors of domestic violence, and hospitalized Iowans would have their absentee ballots counted. The measure also takes aim at county auditors, stripping them of their home rule authority to conduct elections and requiring them to follow guidance from the Iowa Secretary of State. Failure to obey the Secretary of State could result in felony charges being brought against an auditor, and an auditor or election official could face a fine of up to $10,000 for a technical infraction of state election law or failure to follow guidance from the Secretary of State. The law would also rein in many practices election officials implemented last year as they sought to make absentee voting easier during the coronavirus pandemic. Last year, several county auditors mailed absentee ballot request forms to all registered voters in their counties. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate also sent out statewide mailings. The bill would prohibit that practice. Auditors would be required to wait for a voter to ask for a form, and the Secretary of State could send ballot request forms to voters only with legislative permission during a health emergency. Kaufman said he believes 95% of our auditors did a tremendous job in 2020, but that a few brazenly broke the law, referring to three auditors who sent absentee ballot request forms to voters with the voters' information already filled in. Former President Donald Trump's campaign and several Republican groups successfully sued to invalidate those requests. Representative Steve Hansen, Democrat from Sioux City, praised one of the three auditors Kaufman targeted. Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill was trying to make it easier to vote, Hansen said. Brazen? You're right, Hansen said. He brazenly tried to increase voter participation, and I give him kudos. You want to sue him. You want to make it a Class D felony. Good God. According to data from the Nonpartisan National Conference of State Legislators, 43 states offer some form of early voting, and the average starting time for early voting periods is 22 days before the election, 2 days earlier than what Iowa would have if the bill passed Wednesday and becomes law. Iowans have 14 hours to vote on Election Day under current law. That's more than every neighboring state, according to 2020 data compiled by USA Today. Shortening Election Day voting by an hour would leave Iowa even with four of its neighbors. Wendy Underhill, the conference's director of elections and redistricting, said states around the country are taking a new look at absentee and mail voting. The legislation generally takes one of three forms, she said, limiting absentee or mail voting, making the process easier, or fine-tuning the process. She said the wave of interest in mail voting comes after several years of legislation around the country focused on voter registration and identification laws. In the last several years, let's say 2016, 17, 18, 19, voter registration was where most of the legislation was, Underhill said, and in 2020 and 2021, it's sort of shifting over to this really locking down what we do mean by absentee and mail voting. Iowa passed its own voter ID law in 2017, the first year after Republicans seized full control of state government. That law also shortened Iowa's early voting period from 40 days to 29. As of February 19, the Brennan Center for Justice has tracked 253 bills introduced around the country this year with provisions that would restrict voting access, and 704 bills that would expand voting access. Flipping over now to the Metro and Iowa section, our first article is written by Shelby Flagg. Des Moines citations for snowy sidewalks up 82%. Des Moines' exceptionally cold and snowy winter nearly doubled the number of citations against property owners who didn't scoop their sidewalks compared to last year. The city recorded more than 1,000 complaints since December 1st, many of them duplicates regarding the same addresses, and issued 320 citations through the end of last week, said Public Works Director Jonathan Gano. That's an 82% increase from the number of citations issued last winter, when penalties increased for the first time in 15 years, helping to boost compliance along with relatively mild weather. Last winter, from 2019 to 2020, the city issued 176 fines with 360 complaints. The winter before last, which was harsher, the city issued about 400 citations from about 700 complaints. Since November of 2019, fines starting at $75 for a first offense and increasing $25 for each additional violation, $100 for a second and $125 for a third, topping out at $175 for a fifth or subsequent offense. The violations accumulate over 3 years. Des Moines' seasonal snowfall is approaching record territory. As of Saturday, the city had received 52.3 inches of snow this season. According to the National Weather Service, that's about double the 26.4 inches that is averaged through February 20th. Sidewalk complaints can be made starting 48 hours after a snowfall event ends. Once a complaint is received, the city sends out an inspector to document the violation. If complaints are founded, the citations are issued by mail. There is no minimum amount of snow required before the ordinance kicks in, but light snowfalls rarely generate fines, Gano said last year. Residents who receive a citation can file an appeal with the city clerk's office within 10 days. Des Moines residents can report a sidewalk that hasn't been cleared by calling the Public Works customer service number at 515-283-4950 or on the My Des Moines mobile app or using the online reporting form on the city's website. Amber Mahman writes, Iowa Department of Corrections says 19th inmate dies of COVID-19. A Newton Correctional Facility inmate serving 25 years for second-degree sex abuse died Tuesday at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, likely due to COVID-19 complications and pre-existing medical conditions, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections. Kevin John McDonald, age 63, is the first inmate from the Newton Correctional Facility and the 19th in state custody to die of COVID-19. His sentence began on April 25th of 2008. As of 5 p.m. Tuesday, 49 inmates and 3 staff members at Newton Correctional Facility are currently infected with the virus. Across all prisons, 55 inmates and 4 staff members are currently infected with COVID-19. State officials say 4,586 inmates and 696 staff members have tested positive for the virus since March of 2020, and 2 staff members have died from COVID-19. And another article, here written by Amber, homicide suspect dies after being shot by police. The suspect in a fatal Cedar Rapids stabbing has died 3 days after being shot by police. Officers were called in around 1:45 a.m. Saturday to the Roadway Inn in southwest Cedar Rapids, where they found 2 women with stab wounds. The victims directed an officer to a suspect who was seen running from the scene, according to a news release from the Iowa Department of Public Safety. The officer chased the man, later identified as Arnell States, age 39, of Cedar Rapids, and shot him. States received medical treatment on the scene. the release said, before being transported to a Cedar Rapids hospital. He died Tuesday. Katrina Latrice Brinson, age 34, of Cedar Rapids, died from the stab wounds she suffered. The second victim, a 32-year-old woman, was treated at a local hospital and released. The Cedar Rapids officer who shot States has been put on administrative leave, and he has not yet been identified. Janitor charged with child sexual abuse, an article by Philip Jones. A Des Moines Public Schools employee has been put on unpaid administrative leave after being charged with sexual abuse. Jesse Allen McIntosh, age 43, of Des Moines, was arrested Monday and charged with two counts of second-degree sexual abuse of a child under the age of 12. The alleged abuse occurred at a Des Moines residence, according to criminal complaints. McIntosh has worked as a custodian for the Des Moines Public Schools since August of 2018 and has been at Weeks Middle School since August of 2019, according to the Des Moines Public Schools spokesperson. Cleo Krejci writes, Regents okay new free speech policies, want to bolster discussion. Following controversies over free speech this fall, the state's Board of Regents voted to approve policies Wednesday aimed at bolstering free discussion on college campuses, including penalties for free speech violations and restrictions on public policy positions by college leadership. Since the onset of the school year, an Iowa State University professor barred arguments that oppose topics like Black Lives Matter and gay rights, and a conservative student group tweeted that people should arm up after Joe Biden won the presidency. University of Northern Iowa student government leaders prevented an anti-abortion student group from forming, saying it could create a hostile environment on campus, and questions swirled at the University of Iowa after the College of Dentistry summoned a student to a disciplinary hearing for publicly supporting a Trump executive order. Questions about how to handle such incidents and the climate that similar events create on a college campus prompted Board of Regents President Michael Richards to create a committee charged with analyzing the condition of free speech at the three universities in November. The Board of Regents and our universities absolutely support free speech and open dialogue. Every faculty, staff, and student must feel confident that their constitutional rights are protected on our campuses, and that they will not face retribution for exercising their rights, Richards said at a Wednesday meeting. On Wednesday, the Regents unanimously approved 10 recommendations made by the Board's Free Speech Committee, which currently consists of Regents David Barker, Nancy Boninger, and Zach Liest. The committee will remain a permanent fixture of the Regents and will be responsible for handling free speech complaints, reviewing policies, conducting surveys and research, and ensuring universities provide yearly training on free speech. Regents are planning to incorporate the full set of recommendations into current Board of Regents policy and present the final language for approval in April. The universities will also be expected to add policies and procedures, including penalties for violations of free expression, to current policy language. The Regents did not elaborate on what those penalties might entail at the meeting. Members of the college leadership will also be barred from taking institutional positions on policies unless it's in conjunction with the Board of Regents. When the university itself or its departments and administrators take stance on social issues, individuals are discouraged from thinking for themselves, and the mission of the university is compromised, Barker said at a meeting Wednesday. The Free Speech Committee, he said, was created to consider policy changes to counter what we see as disturbing incidents and trends that threaten freedom of expression and freedom of academic inquiry. Earlier this month, the Republican-led House Government Oversight Committee summoned representatives from the three Regents universities to testify about free speech issues on their campuses. In August, an Iowa State professor syllabus said students could not choose any topic that takes at its base that one side doesn't deserve the same basic human rights as you do. That is, no arguments against gay marriage, abortion, Black Lives Matter, etc. The university took corrective action against the professor after that stance came to light. We very quickly moved from this, again, disappointing, to egregious action by one faculty member, addressed that situation, and now have put into place a system-wide approach to prevent that from happening in the future, President Wendy Winterstein said of the incident at the February 2nd legislative hearing. The recommendations by the Regents Free Speech Committee require syllabi to include a statement in support of free speech, a measure Iowa State has already implemented. The statement is expected to be reviewed at the beginning of each course. regents also voted to approve policy language that would prohibit members of the university leadership, including presidents, vice presidents, deans, and department directors, from taking institutional positions on policies unless the statement is made alongside the regents. It's not uncommon for university leadership to take policy positions, and University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld, other top administrators, and 29 members of the College of Dentistry publicly condemned an executive order by the Trump administration just last fall. The order prohibited universities and other public institutions from holding certain diversity trainings that it said suggested individuals can unconsciously hold racist or sexist thoughts. Critics of the order said it clamped down on diversity efforts that challenge systemic racism, and in December, a federal judge in California issued a preliminary nationwide injunction against it. We are deeply disappointed in both the intention behind the languages used in the executive order, which carries the force of law, Harreld wrote in a campus-wide statement at the time. Leadership of the dentistry school, including the dean, sent an email in October to the entire college condemning the order. Many students and faculty replied. One student, Michael Braze, said he thought the university should support the executive order and asked for further clarification about the dental school's position on it. College leadership then summoned Braze to a disciplinary hearing for unprofessional conduct related to the exchange of emails. But the hearing never happened because Braze contacted the state legislators with concerns about his right to freedom of speech being violated. The dentistry's college's dean, David Johnson, apologized to members of the House Government Oversight Committee earlier this month about the incident, both for his public condemnation of the executive order and for the college's initial decision to summon Braze to a hearing. Under the committee's recommendations, the universities would also be prohibited from permitting discrimination or denial of educational benefits because of a student or an organization's viewpoint. In October, student government leaders at the University of Northern Iowa denied a student's request to form a local chapter for Students for Life of America, a national nonprofit that opposes abortion, arguing that the group would create a hostile environment on campus. University President Mark Nook eventually overturned the student government's decision, though citing students' free speech rights. I hope that the recommendations that we have are well received and actions are taken on them to prevent any further incidents, Regent Lee said of the policies voted at Wednesday's meeting. However, I do know, with our recommendations, that we will never completely eliminate freedom of expression issues, because, after all, we all have the right not to agree with each other. Turning now to a piece of news from the Associated Press, Pfizer vaccine works well in big real-world test. A real-world test of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine in more than 500,000 people confirms that it's effective at preventing serious illness or death even after one dose. Wednesday's published results from a mass vaccination campaign in Israel give strong reassurance that the benefits seen in smaller, limited testing persisted when the vaccine was used much more widely in a general population with various ages and health conditions. The vaccine was 92% effective at preventing severe disease after two shots, and 62% after one. It is estimated effectiveness for preventing death was 72% 2 to 3 weeks after the first shot, a rate that may improve as immunity builds over time. It seemed as effective in folks over 70 as in younger people. This is immensely reassuring, better than I would have guessed, said Mayo Clinic's Dr. Gregory Poland. Vanderbilt University's Dr. Buddy Creech agreed. Even after one dose, we can see very high effectiveness in prevention of death, he said. Neither doctor had a role in the Israel study, but both are involved in other coronavirus vaccine work. Both doctors also said the new results may boost consideration of delaying the second shot, as the United Kingdom is trying, or giving one dose instead of two to people who have already had COVID-19, as France is doing, to stretch limited supplies. I would rather see 100 million people have one dose than to see 50 million people have two doses, Creech said. I see a lot of encouragement on one dose in the results from Israel, which were published by the New England Journal of Medicine. The vaccine, made by Pfizer and its German partner, BioNTech, is given as two shots, 3 weeks apart, in most countries. The study was led by researchers from the Clalit Research Institute and the Ben-Gurion University of Negev in Israel, with Harvard University in the United States. It did not report on safety of the vaccine, just effectiveness, but no unexpected problems arose in previous testing. Researchers compared nearly 600,000 people, 16 and older, in Israel's largest healthcare organization who were given shots in December or January, to an equal number of people of similar age, sex, and health who did not receive vaccine. None of the participants had previously tested positive for the virus. And in a companion article, Moderna ships doses of vaccine targeting variant to feds for a study. Moderna announced Wednesday it has brewed experimental doses of its COVID-19 vaccine that better match a mutated version of the virus, ready for tests to tell how the update works. Health authorities say first-generation COVID-19 vaccine still protects against the variants of the disease that are emerging in different parts of the world. But in case the vaccines eventually need to be updated, manufacturers are working on how to tweak their recipes. The variant sparking the most concern currently is the one that first emerged in South Africa. Moderna said it has made doses of vaccine specifically targeted to that variant and shipped them to the National Institutes of Health for a study. U.S. regulators say a revamped vaccine wouldn't need to be studied for months in thousands of people, but it would need testing in several hundred people to see if their immune systems react similarly to the updated shot as to the original. Moderna said it has also begun testing whether simply giving a third dose of the original vaccine would offer an extra immune boost that could guard against variants, even if it's not an exact match. And lastly, here are some of the latest COVID statistics for the state of Iowa. The Iowa Department of Public Health on Thursday was reporting 23 additional COVID-19 deaths and an additional 652 confirmed cases. Deaths are now at 5,438, an increase of 23. Hospitalizations are at 227, down from 233. Patients in the ICU are at 55, down from 57. And there are 22 patients on ventilators, down from 23. Confirmed cases of the disease are now at 334,758. Total tested is 1,550,022. Total recovered, 312,840. 604,483 vaccine doses have been administered. 303,407 of those were first doses. Individuals receiving the second dose is 150,538. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thank you for listening.